Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Marital Rubenstein and Ellen Zweig, artists who are going to be talking about their work that's at the New Mexico Museum of Art. It's called The Portal to Archimedes' Chamber. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Rick Nemias. He's a photographer, writer, and filmmaker, and his latest book is called Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a project involving photographs, essays, stories, prayers. It ranges across a number of religious communities and people in California. How did the idea for this book come to you?
It kind of came from a couple of directions. I had done a project, which we spoke about a couple of years ago, called the Migrant Project, in 2002 and 2003. And what that did is it made me realize that I have a keen interest and maybe an insight into marginalized communities. And I had long wanted to do a project that looked at faith. I had studied religious studies in university, and I found that California is the most diverse religious landscape on the planet. And although I started shooting things that explored that, I didn't really find a focus until one of my advisors, Reverend Paul Chafee from the Interfaith Center at the Presidio, kind of encouraged me one day when I was feeling quite down. We hadn't gotten some grants, and I was just not feeling focused. And he asked me what was it about the Migrant Project that that I kept going through when I had very little funding and very little support. And I said it was really the dignity and inspiration of the stories of people on the margins. And right there, he said, that's the lens for you to look at religion through. And kind of the proverbial light bulb went on, and I didn't look back from that point forward. Not that it was all ease and downhill from there, but at least conceptually, there was a framing to the project that had not existed before then.
This whole concept of the margins implies that there is a center and that the people on the center are ignoring the people on the margins. And when you have a landscape of religion that's as diverse as California or indeed the United States, I wonder how you even really define that.
Yeah, well, I really do see both in the Migrant Project and more importantly, even in Golden States, as California as a microcosm for bigger themes that are both national and even international. It just so happens there's this focused group of people in California. And quite honestly, yes, there is a center. There are mainline churches, mainline synagogues, and mainline mosques amongst many other faiths. But what I have found for the most part are the groups that are represented in this book and in this exhibition, which travels with it, is that these groups have been either cast out or found themselves on the outside of that mainstream for whatever reason. Now, the reasons they're on the outside vary. Some are their own activities, some people that are in prison for, convicted crimes, people who are outside because of their gender or lifestyle, such as the transgender community with the gospel choir, or people that, for the way they were born, people who are deaf, such as the Mormons down in San Diego. I found a wide range of reasons of why people are on the margins, and quite honestly, I found that more interesting to explore than just, say, people who had been cast out by society. I think there is, my insight coming to this is that each one of us has something within us that is marginalized. We may not know it, we may not want to admit it, we may be very ashamed of it, but we all have something in our lives, in our past, in our shadows, that if we're willing to open up, will allow us to look at the stories that these people bring quite candidly and really understand a deeper sense of spirituality.
You know, it's interesting when you say that. I think that the way that people deal with how things in their own lives are marginalized really speaks to their ability to be empathetic with people who are very different from themselves, like the people in this book.
Exactly. One of the things that I'm finding, too, is, this projects come together, I think, in three parts. The first one was the exhibition, which premiered in 06 and 07. And then the book, which took another couple of years to pull together and is just coming out now. And now I've just begun the journey of taking the book back to the communities from which it came, which has been one of my goals from when I took the first photograph, which is I like for the subjects in my work to be able to see their portraits, their stories, in a way that is, again, both dignified and very honest. And so my goal is to bring this book to as many of the communities as I can. And in doing so, what I'm finding is that there is often a mashup. For example, I presented the book at Beit Teshuva, which is the halfway house for recovering Jewish addicts. Sex, gambling, alcohol, drug, whatever addiction you have, this is a halfway house that helps folks use the Torah and the 12 steps to move on with their lives. So they hosted me for both a brunch and a book signing and a talk. And it just so happened that that same day, Miss Major, who is one of the contributors to the book, she wrote a chapter on what it's like to be a transgender in the gospel choir Transcendence. She's one of the eldest transgenders in her early 70s, African-American, amazing obstacles that she's overcome in her life. And so Miss Major was in town while I was going to be at Beit Teshuva, and I invited her to be part of the event. And here was this elder, transgender, black woman in a synagogue for recovering addicts reading her oral history. And the bridge that was built, the empathy, to use your word, that was fostered between these two groups that may not have ever existed before was suddenly something that I realized is the power of taking this book out on the road. I'll be up in the North Bay in San Francisco and above, you know, in coming weeks doing events as well, and being able to have these disparate groups gather, even if it's one or two representatives at the event, and kind of see across the table or across the chapel in some cases, and connect and understand the basic level of humanity within their own spirituality is an incredibly powerful thing, and I feel really, really fortunate to witness that stuff.
I think there's something that I felt in your book, which was a kind of raw and just interesting honesty, which is in contrast to the kind of ideology with an agenda that you see in some of the religious, I have to put it strongly, but, you know, religious propaganda that's all around us all the time. And honesty cuts through a lot of barriers just by its own nature. And there was a wonderful story that you told in your essay about you were taking the project to a group of nuns, and you were trying to figure out how much to self-censor because there was all this stuff about sex workers and transsexual people and stuff like that. And what were the nuns going to? How are the nuns going to feel about it? Tell us that story.
Yeah, that's one of the, you know, one of those kind of lessons that to me spoke volumes, both about the openness of the Immaculate Heart community, which is mostly dispensated nuns who left the Archdiocese in Los Angeles in the early 70s when they chose to follow more feminist doctrine, more social justice action, and were really, really kind of slapped on the wrist by the Archdiocese. And they said, you know what? Forget it. We're going out on our own. And so basically the Immaculate Heart nuns, and there are some men in this order too now, but for the most part, they're elder women. They're women in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They come from an order in Spain which began their outreach to street workers and street walkers. They did not have that kind of pure nun reputation that many of us often see. And I think one of the things I love doing with this book is really turning stereotypes inside out. But what I tried to do that day when I met, because I met with each of the groups before I began photographing them, kind of almost like a courting process to make sure they were interested in the project and they were the appropriate ones for the project. So I went to the Immaculate Heart Community's board meeting, and I was sat in a car because I got there early, and I was about to pull out several of the photographs of the sex workers, because in my gut I felt, before knowing that they had any connection with them, that they would completely turn down this project if they saw those photographs. And The upshot was that I didn't pull the photos. I went with my gut, which said if you start censoring yourself now as an artist, you will lose all integrity on this process, in this progress, in this project, excuse me. And so I let the photographs in. I had the meeting. They agreed to do the project. And then after I shot about 3 months later at their retreat, I was pulled aside by one of the nuns and said, Rick, hope you had a great weekend. It was great having you here. I don't know if anyone told you why we did this project. And I said, no. And she explained the history of Immaculate Heart, having their roots steeped in outreach to disadvantaged women who were prostitutes. And it all came together. It was one of those kind of synergistic moments where you realize on many levels that you followed your own truth and were rewarded for doing so.
We're talking to Rick Namias about his new book, Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. Tell us about the Cham Muslim community.
The Cham literally live in the shadow of Disneyland in Orange County. These are folks who are either direct survivors of genocide from the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, or they're the children of. This is a group that lost, I think it's 250,000 people in this tiny country during those during that genocide. And these folks came over through the 70s and 80s to recreate a community here. Many of them are working blue-collar jobs. They're working a very low-end, have very low-end income, but they have an incredible sense of community in the sense that they tithe a great percentage of their money and send it back to Cambodia, where they're building mosques for the survivors who remained in Cambodia. But there's something also about them that's really quite fascinating. As I said a few minutes ago, I had a kind of a formal, almost courting process with each of the groups. And the Cham were the only group with an organized leader that didn't want me to wait to come to photograph them until there was kind of a group consensus like there was with all these other groups. I had a conversation with Brother Salim Ghazali, their imam, and he said, so when are you coming? And I said, well, you know, I'd love for you to look at the website. I'd love for to come down and show you some of the work I've shot already and talk to you further. He said, no, just come. I said, with my camera? He said, yeah, please come. And so he invited me, and that Sunday I came down and photographed the end of the feast that ended Ramadan. And there was a trusting nature within these people and within this specific community that I had not experienced before. And what was so ironic for me, again, breaking the stereotype of, as we, you know, saw just a week ago with, you know, Bill O'Reilly calling basically Muslims equal terrorists, this was a case in which these were Muslims who were survivors of genocide and had every reason to fear me, but instead trusted me. And what that did for me as a person, let alone a documentarian, was pretty profound. And it gave me a sense of acceptance and a sense of entree into their world, which over the next 2 years, as I revisited them and then came back and did audio recordings, made me really be able to look deeper and was incredibly humbling.
It's very interesting with that community. There's so much beauty in that community, which is reflected in your photographs, and they were people who escaped genocide, and now they're fighting for both cultural and religious survival in a completely different context.
Exactly. It's not a physical, you know, they were people who had just some of the most hideous ways in which they were tortured or you know, left hungry to starve for their lives. Right now, exactly, they're fighting a cultural genocide in a way, because as a community, their children are co-opted by, you know, again, living in the shadow of Disneyland, both metaphorically and literally. They have to deal with kids who are, you know, they're with the cell phones, they're with television, they're with so many things, and they have the scraps of a language and scraps of a culture that they're trying to hold on to, and it's a real challenge. It's one that's reflected in another group at the top of the state, the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, which are a fused group, two tribes of Pomo and South Miwok, who have been on the landscape in California for many hundreds of years, but are also having to scrape together fragments of their dance and their ritual and their language and trying to pass it on to their next generation so it doesn't die out with those elders that are you know, leaving now.
Another theme in the book is people who have been in prison and have found spirituality and really used it for their betterment and for forgiveness in one way or another. And there's more than one community that you show.
Yeah, there's two communities. There's a men's prison, San Quentin Prison, the oldest in the state, a community of Zen Buddhists. And then there is a community, an interfaith community of women at the Chino Prison down in Riverside, California. And quite honestly, you know, many people kind of get confused and they start reading into these people's stories and they're like, well, what are you asking me to forgive them? And there's absolutely no agenda in this book for people to do anything but understand how an individual approaches the themes of redemption in their own life when it comes to the incarcerated communities. I'm not asking anyone to judge or take a stance on the crimes that were committed. And I think there is a chapter written by Vincent Russo, who is a Zen Buddhist. He's one of the members of the San Quentin community, and he writes just so articulately about his coming to terms with his crime, with his place in the world, and his spirituality. And if nothing else, the photographs and stories of the incarcerated groups and the groups on a whole, I just ask that people kind of keep their eyes open long enough to understand that it doesn't matter what you've done in your life, what community you belong to, where you come from, but that we as human beings have a common denominator, and that is, even as atheists, we have to come to terms with the concept of a higher power, whether we choose to embrace it or refuse it or do anything in between. Every human being has to go through that journey, and it's something I feel that we might grow a little bit closer by through understanding that.
Tell us about this other incredibly interesting group of people, Santissima Muerte.
Yes, Santa Muerte is kind of, I'd call it growing exponentially. It is based in Latin America, mostly Mexico and some of the Central American countries. It is, and I won't call it a cult because it is way outgrown the concept of a cult. It is a definite backlash to the Catholic Church and many people who have fallen through the cracks of the Catholic Church, the poor, the people who are working in dangerous communities, in dangerous professions such as addicts, prostitutes, night watchmen, taxi drivers, people who really are kind of living on the edge, have found strength and security through Santa Muerte, who ironically, in our lexicon, looks like the Grim Reaper. It's a female deity that is skeletal and draped in a cloak with a scythe. And I documented a community of sex workers up in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco who all pray to Santa Muerte and have altars to her. And there is a whole, set of rituals that go with this. And there is a chapter in the book about Santa Muerte, beautifully written by Lois Lorenzen, who's a professor of religious studies up at University of San Francisco. And she really delves into where these women come from in Guadalajara and Puerto Vallarta and tracks their journey both physically and spiritually in a way that really makes you understand why it's such an appealing faith for them and why, let's say, Catholicism has not addressed many of the needs that these people have and why Santa Muerte does.
There is, I opened this book and at random, as I often do, just start somewhere, not the beginning, and the first thing I opened it to was somebody who was in this La Santa Muerte group, not cult, as you say. And my first thought was, here are these people who are treated so badly by society. They're the dregs of society by in the view of so many people who look down on them, and they are trying to get some strength and power in a society that doesn't give them power. And, you know, why can't they organize politically? And, you know, why do they have to use religion, which isn't going to do them any good anyway? It's a kind of like religion is the opiate of the masses kind of thing came into my head. And as I was reading it, there is such an interesting strength that comes from it that's really different from the strength you might get from actually organizing.
Yeah, there's something about the Santa Muerte faith and the connection to it where, at least in the sex worker community that I was with, they actually hold mock weddings to Santa Muerte. The deity is very much personified in a way that many faiths do not allow their own gods to be personified and visualized and prayed to, so that the relationship seems not only close, but they're kind of anthropomorphized. You know, you can see that, yes, this is a skeleton and it has a cloak. There's a face to it. It may be ghastly or scary or whatnot, but it's not like a burning bush. And it's in a way that is, it's much more approachable. And I feel that's probably what you're sensing in the strength that many of these folks have, is they feel a much more direct connection rather than getting lost in the masses of the Catholicism from which many of them, or almost all of them, came from. It's really an alternative to Catholicism in many ways, and what's pretty amazing is down in Mexico right now, there's literally millions of Santa Muerte followers, and their numbers have multiplied in such a way that the Catholic Church is really quite up in arms about it. I mean, they see this as a huge threat now, where they used to dismiss it. You're finding that there's a lot of backlash against Santa Muerte followers from the Catholic Church in Mexico.
Well, and there is a real problem with the Catholic Church in Latin America in general, which we've seen, which is that whereas religions like the Santa Muerte or some of the African diaspora religions or some of the evangelical Protestant religions really offer what you might call customer service and real service to their people, the Catholic Church really doesn't.
Yeah, you know, I probably am not the best person to speak to that, but I do have to say, like, I've had the exhibit's been shown now in outside of California, and one of the places it's shown was at a liberal Catholic college called St. Norbert in near Green Bay, Wisconsin. Beautifully presented, and I was really treated wonderfully when I was there, and got a tour of the abbey where the priests are living, and they took me into this crypt, which I'd never been into a crypt under the church before, and behind glass are these gorgeous embroidered vestments, gloves with multiple colors, and I looked at this stuff and I thought of the money and the time and the resources that went into it. And I reflected on the Los Angeles, where I'm from, L.A., the most recent opening of this gargantuan cathedral, $250 million to build a cathedral on the edge of East L.A., which is one of our poorest neighborhoods. And when I looked at these vestments, which are hundreds of years old, and then I thought of the L.A. Cathedral, I saw the same thing, that I totally understand people's argument that the Catholic Church has got its priorities all messed up. And that when you look at customer service, as you say, what are its priorities? What are its goals? Who is it serving? And if you go back to the tenets of Catholicism, is it still really fulfilling those? I can't say, because I'm not a Catholic, but I do feel that people I know who are Catholics, or people who have really left the way of the Catholic Church, they're really seeing a huge identity crisis there right now.
That, by the way, just to attribute properly, that idea of customer service in religion in Latin America comes from a book that we talked about years ago on this program called Competitive Spirits by Andrew Chesnut. It's a very interesting book. But anyway, we're talking to Rick Namias about his new book, Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. This book, this project was originally called The Idea of God in the West, and it transformed and morphed into Golden States of Grace. And I thought the transformation of that title kind of represented a transformation from an academic to a really personal and soulful point of view. Is that true? Did that happen for you?
I really think you nailed it. Yeah, that's exactly it. When I was working on it under that title, it was academic. It was a title I had copped from an old college course where I loved the course. It was one of those courses that many of us have had where, you know, you're taken off guard and your head is kind of blown apart by an amazing professor. And so the name of the thing stuck. And when I got back to California, it made a lot of sense. But as the focus became marginalized communities at prayer and looking at the disinherited through multiple lenses and multiple angles, there was no question that that title really didn't work. And it really was, honestly, the night which I discovered this project through the lens of being focusing on marginalized communities that this title revealed itself. I remember being up in a cafe on Market Street after that dinner where things became very crystalline, and I just sat and I was drawing on, you know, a legal pad, both notes and different titles and buzzwords and things that just were kind of flowing through my head, and these words came together and they really held, and it seemed to both reflect the California spirit, but also what many of these groups have attained, which is grace, and on their own terms, so to speak.
The book has not only essays and stories and photographs and some nice explanatory captions on the photographs, but also prayers. Where did these prayers come from?
When I do a book, my goal is to not just do a catalog. I mean, to me, they're beautiful catalogs of art shows, but to me, especially in this day and age when I feel very fortunate to be able to have a publisher and create a book that could go to Taiwan as well as to France, I want to elevate and deepen people's understanding of the work. And it's an opportunity for me to dive back into the raw material. And in this case, I very quickly knew that I wanted to create something that felt like a contemporary visual prayer book in people's hands. And so we created this softback edition, and then there's a limited edition hardback, which it comes with a signed print, and it's designed and it looks like a holy book, so to speak. And when I started putting the contents of the book together, I really felt that from all the interviews I had done, there was so much articulate material from my subjects that I actually went back to each of the communities and asked for them to write original prayers that would help be the connective tissue for this entire project, that would tie chapters to photographs and photographs to essays and essays onward. And I got an abundance of them. I mean, many, many dozen more than I could use. And then my goal was to never put a prayer from the same group that the photograph next to it was from, so that they would reflect on each other and further the story without duplicating it. And it was an amazing process. It was very delicate. It was really like a house of cards. But it was also something that I felt incredibly privileged to do. So I had these stacks of prayers that came to me in email. They came in handwritten napkins. They came, you know, in all different fashions. And I still have them, you know, here in my studio. But once I had the prayers and the photographs kind of lined up on the boards in my studio, I noticed that there were certain phrases that were calling out to me. They were you know, like pull quotes almost. And those phrases appeared in every single prayer. And ultimately what I decided to do was to take a phrase or a few words from every single prayer and use those as the raw material to write the final prayer in the book myself, which is called An American Prayer, and it's on the very last page. And it's a culmination of the spirit and the content and the input from all these individuals. And it felt very special to be able to work with that. And that, again, once I had all those things cut up almost like a giant ransom note on a table, I would order and reorder those phrases till they fell into the order that they're now presented in, which really felt both respectful, but also, again, took people through, in almost a summary, a journey of the book and the themes that are presented there.
We're talking to Rick Nemias about his book, Golden States of Grace. It's such an interesting book, and I hope it sells well and that a lot of people see the exhibit, which is traveling right now, because it's very honest, it's very beautiful with its black and white photographs, it's introspective. It clearly has changed you, the author, the photographer, and it also has the potential to be political in a certain way, and that's such an interesting combination.
You know, I really appreciate that. I think that your insight into it's really so keen, because when I did the Migrant Project, there was no question that there was there were political ramifications from the first frame I took. And I had seen in the years that I photographed this, 03 to 06, a huge even deepening of the margins, where during the Bush administration there was a very clear sense of co-opting of faith and emerging of that with you know, what was happening in politics. And as we can tell even right now as we near an election, that there is no question about, you know, the separation of church and state really being an ongoing struggle. And, yeah, there's no question. Several of these groups deal with social justice. Several of these groups are, you know, legally discriminated against. Several of these groups really, I think, call on us to re-examine both our concepts of spirituality, but also our concepts of who belongs, who judges, and who has a place in our society and who is pushed to the margins. You know, I too hope the book sells well. I'm so pleased that there's a wonderful photo bookstore in Santa Fe called Photo Eye, and they're one of the few bookstores that right at the very top of seeing this book stepped up and agreed to both carry the soft cover and the hard cover, which is quite an expensive book because it's a limited edition. But they're a Santa Fe stalwart, and I really, you know, kind of want to give them a shout out for, you know, not just appreciating the aesthetic of the book, but also not shying away from the themes and the politics of it. I think it says a lot for your community.
Well, thank you. I think it's a good Santa Fe book, a good New Mexico book, but above all, it's, even though it's based in California, but above all this, the political question, which I think is so relevant to our time and under-discussed, is this question of judging others versus examining ourselves.
Yeah.
And this book, in a funny way, through presenting all these other communities who are maybe going to be unlike the readers who buy the special edition or buy the regular edition, at the same time, give us this opportunity to look at ourselves and think about ourselves in a different way.
Yeah, that's it. To me, it is about seeing the us in them. If there
exactly.
is one kind of common denominator in all the work I do, it's that theme. And it's something that I get a huge amount of satisfaction of. A week ago, I had the privilege of going back to Chino Prison to present the work to the Women of Wisdom, which is the group there that I documented. And to my delight and surprise, my parents came with me. And my parents come from an entirely different world. They're wonderful people, but they're not the people that would spend their time doing outreach to prisons. That's just not in their, you know, lexicon of activities to do. Yet when they entered and so kind of surrendered to the activity, to the presentation, and then to these kind of wonderful little group discussions that were spurred by the presentation I gave, I was so impressed to see how much, you know, these are folks who live in an upper-middle-class lifestyle in West Los Angeles, have a great deal of abundance in their life, immediately found themselves open and moved by the inmates around them that were incredibly candid about their stories and their spiritual journeys. And I've seen that as I've presented the book at different places, and it feels so rewarding to see those bridges being crossed, even if it's for a moment. It doesn't have to be anything that lasts forever, and I don't have any expectations of that being the case, but just that momentary connection of someone going from an us to a them and seeing the ground that we all share is a really rewarding thing, and I feel really privileged to be able to do that with my work.
And I think, and this is something that comes up for me personally a great deal doing this radio show, is that I think part of coming to empathy, coming to maturity, coming to a new kind of politics is expanding out what us means. I mean, for some people, it's their blood relatives. For some people, maybe it's their blood relatives and the people they went to school with, you know. And pretty soon, it's your whole community, and pretty soon, it's people, and pretty soon, it's prairie dogs and wolves and bears and things like that, and the atmosphere of the earth itself. And when you start thinking of us in that way, pretty soon you're getting into kind of definitions of God and spirit, and it sort of comes to you that that's what this is all about in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's something about reclaiming the sacredness of our everyday rituals that I've actually found myself in, again, in these last few weeks as this book has been birthed, finding myself appreciating just the simplest of things that can be defined as sacred moments, and I think that are often overlooked. And I think in the kind of exponential ramping up of information that bombards us, the attention that's pulled in every direction, it really behooves us to stop and say, what is still sacred in my life, and how do I hold on to that, and how do I share it?
Rick Namias is a photographer, writer, and filmmaker, and his latest book is called Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. It is published by the University of New Mexico Press, which is on the web at unmpress.com, and the website for the book is goldenstatesofgrace.com. Rick, thanks for being with us again on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for, you know, the thoughtfulness of this interview. It's really great to have a host that really kind of looks deeper into things.
Thank you so much. I'd like now to welcome artists Meridel Rubenstein and Ellen Zweig. Their installation, The Portal to Archimedes' Chamber, is installed at the New Mexico Museum of Art. It's within a large exhibition called Case Studies from the Bureau of Contemporary Art, which is works from the permanent collection of that museum. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
So this piece that is owned by the museum and which is being displayed right now is part of a larger collaboration that you both worked on, what, sort of almost 20 years ago, called Critical Mass.
Yeah.
And that is about a whole lot of questions that arise from issues of the Manhattan Project, nuclear weapons, Oppenheimer, and New Mexico, and this crazy setting that we are living in. What was the inspiration for the project?
Ah. Ellen. I can start. I came to visit Meridel here in Santa Fe. I'd never been here before, and we wanted to do something together. We were looking for subject matter, and Jerry West took us to Edith Warner's house. And he knew Ellen had been doing work about Victorian lady travelers who photographed. She'd been doing performance works and with giant pinhole cameras. And so we were kind of looking for a subject about a woman and where we could use photography. And so Jerry said, well, we'll take you over here. And so he introduced us to Edith Warner and those stories about her. And then we began. It was a perfect story for us because Ellen's work had been about Victorian women, and my work at that point, I was really looking for a subject that had, in those days, had mythological import, but intent. But also, I was trying to get in the present. I'd been doing the Labyrinths and Constellations series, and I was kind of trying to bring that work into the present. So this was a story that had amazing, possibilities.
Tell us who Edith Warner was.
Edith lived at Ottawa Bridge, the way we saw her, she was a poet. She also served Cokes and took in the mail for the Chili Line. And then later, when the Manhattan Project started, she Oppenheimer knew her. And in order to help her make money at that time, because of the Manhattan Project, the road was closed to most people. He organized dinners at her house for the scientists, for his friends, basically by invitation.
So that her home became the one place that the scientists could get off base and actually meet up with the regular people, have a real experience of New Mexico. And I think that was important to Oppenheimer anyway, in the sense that he brought the whole bomb project right to Edith's backyard when he was advised to go other places, even in the state, because he'd had such a kind of powerful experience there as a young man. But he just felt very comfortable with her. And we used to take poetic license in saying that it was her, it was the whole allure of her place, her feeling of domesticity and warmth, the whole Pueblo world, and the idea that natives were doing these amazing rituals to unleash energy, that he really wanted it right there against, and it was a totally impractical place to do it. It was just a mud trail going up the hill.
Now, presumably, she had no idea what these people were doing.
Absolutely not, yeah.
And yet, in your view, did she influence them in significant ways?
Well,
I think she gave them a place to rest and socialize, and also to meet the people of the Pueblo, because she lived with a man named Tulano Montoya. People of the Pueblo were often around her house. The scientists, I mean, we were particularly interested in that meeting. That was a powerful thing to us.
See, they were very young. You know, when you think, it's hard to remember this, but they were just, you know, many of them just out of graduate school. But Edith was older, and she was particularly close to Niels Bohr, who visited, who was not part of the Manhattan Project, but was as old as she was. And at least in our thinking, it was like the two of them had a sense of time and ramifications, you know, of things that could happen, whereas the rest of the scientists weren't really able at that point to think ahead at all. So,
now, why is the piece called Archimedes' Chamber, or the portal to Archimedes' Chamber?
I wrote a text called If Archimedes, which is the text that's in the sound piece of the piece at the museum. I was reading about Archimedes, who made great brass mirrors directing the sun to burn the approaching Roman ships to save his city, the city of Syracuse. And I realized that nobody ever said that he was an evil guy, and yet people were always saying that Oppenheimer was an evil guy. So I didn't want to answer this question. I just wanted to ask the question.
Which is, if
Archimedes made these weapons and people remember him as a hero who saved his city, then why can't we think of Oppenheimer that way? On the other hand, if Oppenheimer is an evil guy who made this horrible weapon, why can't we think of Archimedes that way? So it's just a question that I wanted to put out there, sort of a question about history and how we
view it. It's a weird parallel, too, because Archimedes got killed by Roman soldiers.
Mm.
And Oppenheimer got, if not killed,
got
pretty
ill,
pretty ruined by,
yeah, yeah,
by his
yeah,
own government.
Yeah,
yeah.
So with a piece like this, the audience comes to it, they hear your poetry, they see images of Edith Warner, of mushroom clouds, of Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. of teacups, of, you know, the domestic mm-hmm. things of New Mexico landscapes. It seems very, very suggestive without trying to make any one point. It's sort of giving you a lot of things to take home with you.
We had, in the midst of our collaboration, I mean, that was a big, discussion we had. We weren't taking sides. There's another piece called The Meeting that presents the scientists on one side and the native people on the other. We can talk about that in a minute. But everyone's there together. And what you do come away with is here are these famous people and here are these ordinary people. You know, people that made history, people that supposedly didn't. And everybody's there equally, as well as in the dinner. The video play that we have.
What's the nature of that meeting?
In the meeting, so there's several pieces in the larger Critical Mass show that are about their actual meeting of these two groups of people. And so Oppenheimer got Edith to turn her home into a little cafe, and younger people from the Pueblo were the waiters. Her partner Chilano grew the food, and dinners were served, so people actually met there. In addition, many of the older people of the Pueblo were housekeepers, some people, you know, attendants, technicians, whatever. So we were looking for stories where people exchanged. It came together. And in one piece of the meeting, what happens is on one wall are portraits of living Manhattan Project scientists, and on the other wall, people who were living at that point, 1993, who in some way met. Either they met as, you know, servers of the dinners, or in one case, Louis Naranjo helped liberate death camps and then came back and brought the Vigas to build. And we didn't tell you the story yet, but there's Edith, everyone knows, in, at least in Santa Fe, the house at Ottawa Bridge, but many don't know that after the war, so Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project was a hidden city, and after the war it became Los Alamos, so the road then was widened and went right through Tilano's garden right next to the house, so they needed to move. And so scientists, the Pueblo offered land on the other side of the road, and the scientists offered materials, and the two groups got together every weekend to build. There are lots of stories about that, but the point being that this was another example. So in this piece, the meeting, they all knew each other from this experience. And so interlaced like a checkerboard are objects with the scientists' objects that went into the making of the first bomb, or objects that Pueblo people chose to represent them. And in the middle is a video where an old woman braids and unbraids her hair. And so it's this always this weaving is what we were interested in. The same thing happens again in the dinner, the video play that Ellen wrote.
What was the collaboration between the two of you like?
Well, it was great. I mean, we had a great time. Let me start by saying that when we met, I was a poet and performance artist, but I was also making performances. I was making camera obscuras. Meridel was a photographer. I saw her incredible Labyrinth series and just thought that visual power was something that I wanted to connect with. We also involved the Vasulkas, and I always say Woody and Stana taught me video. I am now a video artist. So making the videos with Meridel, with the technical help of Stana and Woody, that got me to where I am today. So the collaboration, sometimes it would be that I was writing, Meridel was taking photographs. So sometimes it would be separate. Sometimes it would be that we were working on a video together, really together, every decision made together. The concepts were always decided together.
Yeah. It was wonderful. It was the happiest time of my life.
Really?
Yeah, it was absolutely great.
So what's it like? We've just got less than a minute left, but what's it like to now see that one piece of the larger installation in the museum all these years later?
I think that's a big question. That's a big question, because we haven't seen it since December 1996.
Because they acquired it then.
Yeah, and so we were so worried. You know, we worried about the technology. And we've had some technical problems that we're fixing, but so to get through this and actually see it again and have it at least speak to us is just fantastic.
Yeah, I think it holds up.
Yeah, we think it holds up.
we hope it does.
We wanted it to hold up, and we think it probably does.
Meridel Rubenstein and Ellen Zweig are artists whose installation, The Portal to Archimedes' Chamber, which is part of a larger piece called Critical Mass, is right now at the New Mexico Museum of Art. It's in their exhibition, which is called Case Studies from the Bureau of Contemporary Art. It's a lot of work from their permanent collection, all sorts of very famous artists that we have in our permanent collection at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.